Welcome to Historically St. Pete, a weekly conversation where we explore the truths and possibly the myths of the people and events that created the Sunshine City. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Rui Farias, and I have the best job in town. I'm the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. The museum has been sharing the stories of the Sunshine City for 102 years, and we are happy to share those stories with you here on Radio St. Pete. For decades, visitors and residents driving along Park Street in West St. Pete have passed some version of a historical marker or sign declaring that Spanish explorer Pánfilo de Narváez came ashore on that spot with about 300 of his men and began really what is to be known as the first European inland expedition of what was to become the United States. Now, there's been some spirited debates on whether or not Narváez actually landed on that spot, now known as the Jungle Prada area. After all, it is rumored that it was landowner Walter Fuller who placed that first sign to sell valuable historic land. But we now know that the location's history extends well beyond the arrival of the Spanish. And of course, let's not forget its checked yet spirited history from the early 20th century. Today's guest on Historically St. Pete has long family ties to that mysterious land. David Anderson's family have owned land on that site since his grandfather, Harold Happy Anderson, purchased the 3 acres back in 1940. But it's been David who's worked on to maintain the site and open sacred lands to the public. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rui.
So your family ties to St. Pete really date back to your great-grandfather, Theodore, who was an early pioneer of the city. But it was your grandfather, Happy, who kind of took Anderson Lumber, a company still in business today, right? Yeah. To basically a whole new level and purchase that historic land at Bogusiga Bay. What was there at the time?
Theodore Anderson came from a little town in New York called Livingston Manor, and the story I've always heard is he kept a mule on Anna Maria Island, which gave him an advantage over other builders. He was building at the site where Anderson Lumber is since 1908, and my grandfather, Happy, opened the retail operation. Happy took the trolley to the Jungle Prada area when he was young in the 1920s. He was friends with the family that owned the bait shop at Jungle Prada called the Truesdales and would go fishing. They were all fishing guides. And Happy was there in 1924 when a Smithsonian archaeologist named J. Walter Fuchs, I believe he was head of the Bureau of Ethnicity, came to St. Pete and did explorations at Whedon Island and Jungle Prada. And so the mound was there, but the property was kind of a jungly area that was part of a large, about a 5-square-mile tract that had been purchased by Walter P. Fuller. So it was a mound in the jungle when he got there.
So we were talking a little earlier. So tell me the story about your grandfather opening the retail part of this lumber and what your great-grandfather thought about this.
Sure. My great-grandfather had a lot of pride in being a builder and making things with your hands. And so the story I've heard is that when my grandfather opened a retail operation, a lumber yard, in 1949, that it was kind of looked down upon by his dad because he was a merchant and not a builder, and there was more pride in being a builder.
There you go. So your grandparents purchased the property. Wasn't just Happy, though. So let's talk about your grandmother, who really turned that into what it is today.
Well, yeah, Happy, despite being called a merchant by his dad, was a builder, and so he built the house there. But my grandmother, Frances Marshall Anderson, planted the gardens, and she had polio from a young age. He married her when she already was in a wheelchair with polio, and he took her off the farm in New York where she lived and to St. Pete, where she became the office manager, the switchboard operator for Anderson Lumber Company. And Walter Fuller mentioned my grandparents in his book and has the line that his valiant wife ably assisted him from a wheelchair at the lumberyard. My grandmother was a horticulturalist. She had some important friends in that field. She knew David Fairchild. She knew Mulford Foster, the father of the bromeliad, and she was part of starting what was called the Suncoast Botanical Garden and now is called the Florida Botanical Garden in Largo.
Very nice. So you mentioned about your grandfather taking the trolley out there to the jungle area, right? So you've got to verify if this is true. So I've got all kinds of stuff about this area that we're going to put you on the hook here for today.
I'll try.
So the story goes that, you know, when you're that happiest young boy, when he'd ride the trolley out there, that he was even present to witness the day the archaeologist found a 16th century Spanish sword. Is that true?
According to him, that's true. he gave a oral history to folks, some archaeologists from the Central Gulf Coast Archaeological Society back in the 90s before he passed away. He died in 1997, and he told the story. Walter Fuller also told the story, and they agree they found a hilt of a Spanish sword there, but that it was stolen, so we can't look at it now.
Okay, all right. So they purchased the land, right? Primarily a jungle-looking area. That's why that area has that name, with an Indian mound on it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what did they envision?
Well, I don't know what they were thinking in 1940, but I will say that it took 13 years between when grandfather bought the property and when he actually moved his family there. Before that, they moved. They lived in a small house on the grounds of the lumberyard, and I just read on the lumberyard's website. I had no idea that they had slate shingles on their roof from Fort DeSoto buildings, and kind of they pieced that building together at the lumberyard. My impression is grandfather bought the property for preservation. He knew there used to be more mounds along Park Street than there are now, and some of the bigger ones were already used as fill, kind of taken apart and used for development by the time he bought the property in 1940. And he said in his oral history that the reason this mound was still there is it was had so many trees growing out of it, it was hard to take apart. So I think he meant to preserve it, but eventually he moved the family there.
So you mentioned the developers, and I wanted to hit on that a little bit. So, the story goes that basically if you were on a boat and you left the Gandy area and just went around the Pinellas Peninsula, or southern part of the Pinellas Peninsula, where St. Petersburg is, and you looked ashore, that you would literally see hundreds of Indian mounds. Obviously, 99% of them are gone, right? Mm-hmm. So the developers used them for fill. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So famously in St. Pete in the 1920s, the streets were paved with brick, and we see a lot of the Augusta Block and the Rock Mart and the other bricks around town. But my understanding is before the bricks were the popular material, it was shell roads, and that the most readily available source of shell were the Indian mounds, which were mostly built out of shell. I'll say a lot of times when people think Indian mound, they think burial mound, but not all of them have human remains, mm-hmm. but there are big shell middens and waste management sites and ceremonial places, but they all seemed like pretty... And grandfather said they could back the trucks up to the mounds and the workers could stand on top and they could shovel downhill from the high ground, so it made the mounds kind of a prime target.
There was a photograph I know that we have at the museum from the Evening Independent that shows city workers. I think the photograph was from the 50s, and I was shocked that this still happened as late as the 50s. Mm-hmm. But it showed city workers with a dump truck and shoveling material into an alley to fill potholes. And the cut line under the photograph says that it was crushed shell from one of the mounds that they were using. So, and you're right. A lot of people they think that the word or the term Indian mound, and they think that it's automatically a burial mound, and majority of them probably weren't, right? So they lived, a lot of the Togabaga and the other natives in this area lived from the sea, ate a lot of clams, oysters, all that stuff, and actually they become good vantage points, right? Because there's not many hills in St. Pete. No. So you build your own, you can climb up at the top and see where your enemies are, the big Spanish ships that eventually sailed into this area. So that entire area, that whole Jungle Prado area, has so much amazing history. And before we dive into sacred lands, let's talk a little bit about Jungle Prado. So in 1924, Walter P. Fuller engaged Henry Taylor to design the Jungle Prado, which is the actual structure still out there today. It was copied after a venue in Havana. Mm-hmm. Fuller knew, right, that to sell lots in the outskirts of St. Petersburg, which was basically what the jungle area was, he would need to provide some convenient access to life's necessities and pleasures. So he built our first shopping mall, mm-hmm. basically, there. It included a drugstore, a grocery store, a photography shop, landscape and nursery store, a hardware store, a drapery store. It had a public waiting room for streetcars when the streetcar passengers would come out. And it had a fully equipped garage and filling station. But probably the coolest thing it had was the Gangplank Lounge.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so this is our area's, St. Pete's first true nightclub. And this is the 1920s. What was happening in the 1920s?
Prohibition.
Right, which we didn't really care about here in St. Pete, right? It was like, I say all the time that we looked at it as a suggestion, right? Uh-huh. Right, more than a law. Right, so the Gangplanks Terrace overlooked you know, the Jungle Pier and Bogotá Bay, and people would dance outdoors, you know. And of course, there's no shortage of bootleg liquor. It arrived by land, it arrived by sea, it was stashed in a house right by your family's property. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, eventually, when Fuller cut that little strip out of the jungle there and made his own his airfield, it was transported out of the area by plane. So, without giving away any family secrets, what was it like growing up in this such a historic space? I mean, and what did you come across as a boy? Did you discover any cool stuff?
You know, I found luckily for the sanctity of the mound, I wasn't much into history when I was growing up there. I did explore the mound. I liked to ride my bike down the hill. But I found an arrowhead or two growing up. I was aware of the archaeologists there in the 1990s. I always appreciated the property, the jungle. The jungle landscape there is full of, you know, multi-hundred-year-old oak trees, and it's on the water. So what kid wouldn't appreciate that? But the appreciation for the history, I knew I was lucky to be there, but the historical significance hit me later in life.
Okay. So that takes us to sacred lands. I mean, your family's had this beautiful historic oasis on Bogotá Bay for, you know, decades. So tell us, you know, a little bit about what your grandmother started there and how it continued, right? Mm-hmm. And now what you're doing there.
Absolutely, sure. Thank you. So my grandparents knew the historical value of the site, and they wanted to share it. They didn't want to lock it away and keep it to themselves. And so I think from the very beginning, they structured their lives in a way to share that property with people. My grandmother being in a wheelchair, a lot of the garden clubs and groups that she was part of, their buildings weren't ADA accessible. It was before the days of those regulations. And so she, grandfather built the living room to seat 70, and they would have their meetings there. They would have school groups. I ran across a newspaper article where a group of Japanese exchange students were touring the site. They would do an annual plant sale, and Happy would give garden tours. So from the very beginning, I think they wanted to make this something that they privately stewarded and protected, but made publicly available. And so my grandparents got older, and my parents come along, and our family moves, my mom and dad and I, to the site when I was 8 years old, 1990. And in 2001, my parents' way of sharing the property with the public was to start Sacred Lands Preservation and Education, which is a 501c3 nonprofit started in 2001, and they aim to hold events that bring people to the site. It's essentially a preservation nonprofit, so they're interested in preserving the land and other sites in Florida that also have archaeological value, and educating about the Native Americans who live there and the early days of St. Petersburg. But my parents have always had an interest in culture, so they've had musical events and social gatherings and other sorts of gatherings at the Sacred Lands property, which a lot of folks know the property is Sacred Lands now, but that's the name of the nonprofit. And then lastly, I'm helping out with those events now, but in 2017, I got really interested in the history. I had been a professional tour guide before that, worked at some other places, including Sunken Gardens here in St. Pete's. But I started a small business called Discover Florida Tours in order to offer my guided historical tour of the site, where we start by the water and walk up to the mounds and tell all the stories of the history. So I do that, and now I also help out with the Sacred Lands Preservation events.
So when someone takes one of these tours, what can they expect to learn?
Oh, boy. Well, when I say it in one sentence, I usually pick, you'll see plants, peacocks, hear about Tocobaga Indians and Spanish explorers. We have a garden with some of the plants that grandmother grew and some plants that were used by native people. We start by exploring the water, and it's kind of sort of a little botanical tour and history of the property. I've enjoyed uncovering some interesting stories about the history of our Gulf beaches. When you look out at Bocasiega Bay from our lot, you're looking at Treasure Island and John's Pass. So part of the history, which we haven't talked about, we might not get to, is that John Levesque, for whom John's Pass is named, had a homestead along the coast there, and probably chose that area because of the high ground of the mounds. So we talk a little bit about who John Levesque was. We talk about the history of the Gulf beaches, the hurricane history of the Gulf beaches. And then I walk folks up, we meet the peacocks, and we go up to the plaza and the main midden. And the main midden, I've recently started calling the largest American Indian mound that's located on private property in Florida, actually. I'm pretty sure that's true until someone finds a bigger one, but that's what Google AI says, and so it's got me started calling it the largest American Indian mound that's not on publicly stewarded land.
Hey, listen, this is Florida, right? We just say things enough time and everybody believes it.
So I learned from Walter Fuller.
There you go. You learned from one of the best. Peacocks. When's the best time to see these peacocks?
Well, the peacocks are there all year, but there is a best time to see them, and it's in the springtime. That's their mating season, and that's when the male peacocks put on their mating display. They each pick a little territory, and they spend all day showing off. And folks who don't live around peacocks might not realize they shed their feathers every year, so they grow a new set every spring. And if you want to see the full display with the feathers that have a 8 or 10 foot spread and they're flexing them for the females, you would come in February, March, April, May. In summertime, June and July, they start to shed those feathers. But that's also when the babies are there. So it depends on if you want to see pea chicks or if you want to see the mating display. But there's always peacock activity at the site.
There you go. All right, so I got to ask you this. What's your take on the Narvaez story?
My take is there is very good evidence to suggest that he landed on our coast, and probably even at that village. You know, the village wasn't just our site. We talked about mounds being being removed for fill. Walter Fuller in his book says there were something like 25 or 27 mounds mm-hmm. along that coast. There's some compelling evidence. You know, I'll say one of four survivors of the expedition, Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, wrote a book. And a lot of how we determine where they landed is just piecing together excerpts from his book, things that Cabeza de Vaca said. And I guess the best pieces of evidence that he landed at our site, to my knowledge, are that the party walked north until they came to a bay that seemed to sweep a long ways inland. They followed that coast, and they found a village that seems to match the safety harbor description. Mm-hmm. And also, when Narvaez separated from his ships, the ships went north looking for a harbor that matched the description of Tampa Bay, and they couldn't find one. But they did find one 5 leagues south of the landing in Cabeza de Vaca's book, 5 leagues, which he calls the best harbor in the world. So he got a little bit of that promotion as well. And that seemed to sweep a long ways inland and had that village at the head of it, which they had seen. So that seems to line up. And there's... I won't speak for him, but there's a gentleman who's writing books right now. Jim McDougald mm-hmm. is writing books where he's done a lot of research, and he's actually uncovered something really interesting, which I would like to dig into more about a navigator's handbook that was available at the time and lists 2 bays where there's really only one on our coast.
Right.
And he thinks that maybe that means that, and has good reason to think, I believe, that they were conflating these 2 bays and that they thought there was one to the north, but there wasn't, and where they actually were was just along the coast, just north of the entrance of Tampa Bay.
Sure. Okay. Excellent. So, a lot of water talk, right, because of the location of where it is, mm-hmm. and I mean, we've just experienced 2 incredible hurricanes, Helene and Milton, that have devastated parts of St. Petersburg. How did Sacred Lands fare?
Well, these were the worst hurricanes of my life, and so back-to-back, we got all the elements of one catastrophic hurricane spread out over 2. So Helene brought the storm surge, and that was the most destructive part for Sacred Lands. You know, I've always made the joke that nobody had to tell the Tokabaga to buy flood insurance, and they knew to build up using Shell.
Absolutely.
And never has that been more true, because the plaza, which they built up 12 feet high, and the midden, which is almost 25 feet high, were both above the surge of Helene and were relatively undamaged. But our entrance from the Jungle Prada Park next door leads into the area near the water, where we have a stage, a waterfront deck, a small cabin, a grandmother's old commercial greenhouse that we've been using for events. And the only of those structures to survive the storm surge was the stage. Luckily, our stage is okay. It's got 8x8, you know, supports with a couple hundred pounds of concrete holding them in. But the greenhouse where we had some of our museum artifacts and our waterfront seawall that grandfather poured are really in shambles right now. And then Milton brought the wind, which knocked over some trees on the mound. But the real damage was done by the storm surge from Helene.
I follow you guys on social media, and I've seen that you had a lot of volunteer events where people have been coming out to help to clean the place up. So that's tremendous to see the community support there.
Yeah, my father has been the caretaker there for many years, and he's getting older. He's 78 years old, and I'm helping him. But a lot of times, as far as caring for the grounds, it's a two-person operation. And so we really do need to appeal, I think, to some of the people that enjoy our events that we invite the public to. Sure. We've done some kind of Facebook and social media advertised volunteer events, but actually, until we get things going again, I'm going to start, I think, just doing Saturday be a volunteer morning. So it won't be this coming Saturday because I've got a tour scheduled, but I think within a few weeks, I'm just going to set aside Saturday morning from about 9 to 1 to let anyone come who wants to work with us just on a volunteer basis.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So we could use the help, and if you have time on a Saturday, get in touch.
So every time a hurricane threatens our area, I get calls from local and national media asking about the Indian curse, right? Mm-hmm. No exaggeration. Every storm that comes through here. So during Milton, I got numerous phone calls, and you know, including from newspapers in New York, wanting to know about this Indian curse. I mean, they want to, you know, want to know more about the Tocobaga protections. So tell us, do you believe in this?
You're putting me in a tough spot. I would never want to do anything.
Never want to speak poorly against the Tocobaga. No, never.
No, I wouldn't want to do that. You know, everyone's got a different opinion about how that affects things. And I think the Tocobaga picked a place to live that was where hurricanes were relatively infrequent. Obviously, they do come, but if you look at the track record, kind of how that legend got started, it's because we've been so fortunate.
Sure.
And they built up, but they didn't build permanent settlements on the barrier islands, to my knowledge. And so that says to me that they didn't think they were immune from hurricanes. Yeah, I don't want to say a bad word about it, and if it helps 0.5%, I don't want to lose that, and I also don't want to offend anybody who fully believes that there were protections put on the mounds. And I will say one thing about that I'm not aware of a particular hurricane protection ceremony that the Tocobaga did. I wish we knew more about their ceremonies. It's hard to tell because most of what we know was recorded by the Spanish, who are not the best, I always say, anthropologists. But I do meet people who are of other American Indian origin and have heard in some cultures of protection ceremonies from natural disasters. And so it seems to make sense to me, I say this on the tour, to make sense to me that the Tocobaga were aware of the threat posed by hurricanes. They were interested in protecting their homeland, and they would have done just about everything in their power to make that work. And if I don't want to turn anybody off from their beliefs. So, you know, people are free to believe what they want.
Absolutely not. I always respond with, I'm sure that science has something to do with this, but I'm going with the Tocobaga thing because it's worked so far, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us, tell the listeners, where do they go to find out more information about your tours?
Sure. Well, since I've been helping out more with the sacred lands, the website for the nonprofit does have a link, but I would send people to my tours website, which is discoverfloridatours.com, discoverfloridatours.com, or you can search the Jungle Prada History Tour. A lot of folks know the property is sacred lands, and you can get there that way, but we are on the National Register of Historic Places as the Jungle Prada site, and so the official name is the Jungle Prada Site History Tour.
I encourage everyone to take this tour. It's a fabulous tour. It's a great property to go visit. And if you've got time to volunteer, please do so and help them get back on their feet. So, David, thank you so much for joining us on Historically St. Pete and sharing this fantastic history with us. I invite everyone to tune in weekly to RadioSt.Pete.com for Historically St. Pete and to stop by the Museum of History on your next visit to the pier and to explore the rich and unique history of our Sunshine City. Visit HistorySt.Pete.org for more details on our exhibits and events. Once again, thank you for listening and join us next week on Historically St. Pete.